Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ain't No Grave by Mary Glickman. Narrated by Alexandra Kohler. Oh, shame is a prison as cruel as a grave. Shame is a robber, and he's come to take my name. Oh, love is my redeemer, lifting me up from the ground. Love is the power where my freedom song is found. Ain't no grave gonna hold my body down. Ain't no grave gonna hold my body down. Oh, fear is a liar with a smooth and velvet tongue. Fear is a tyrant. He's always telling me to run. Oh, love is a resurrection, and love is a trumpet sound. Love is my weapon. I'm gonna take my giants down. Ain't No Grave. Lyrics by Claude Ellie, Jonathan David Helser, Melissa Helser, and Molly Skaggs. 1. Heard County, Georgia, 1906. There were many things 9-year-old Maxwell Isidore Sassaport would never have done if it weren't for the influence of his best friend, Ruby Elfreda Johnson, among them visiting a witch woman in the most isolated territory of the backwoods. Max was a good boy, obedient and loving. Lying and theft were normally far from his mind. But Ruby tickled the adventurous side of him. She tickled it good. When he awoke that morning, Max did as his daddy trained him. He picked up the pitcher kept by the side of his bed and poured water over his hands and into the basin it sat in, murmuring thanksgiving for the return of his soul to his body. For a minute or two, he imagined places his soul might have wandered while he slept. No matter how many times he questioned Daddy on the matter, he'd never got a satisfactory answer. Daddy was eccentric in his choice of which Jewish traditions he kept and which not. His choices boiled down to what he felt like doing in the privacy of his own home and what he dared not do in the company of his neighbors, a mixed crew of both Philo and anti-Semites, all of them in stark ignorance of what Jews were really about. When Max came of age a few years later, there was no bar mitzvah. He didn't notice. He only vaguely knew what a bar mitzvah was. There were no other Jews in Buckwood, Georgia, to compare with his own. As far as Max knew, the only Jews around were Mama, Daddy, Bubby, and Zadie. Sometimes a stray cousin or uncle passed through, but that was it. Daddy would have liked to teach the boy to keep a kosher home. Mama flat out refused to maintain one. "There's no shochet out here," she said. "We supposed to live on plants? No, we'll eat like everybody else, and that's final." Her mother and father, who'd grown up kosher but dropped it with reluctance somewhere between Kiev and Raleigh, lived with them. They protested some out of guilt. They got nowhere. It was true that without a kosher butcher, there wasn't much in Buckwood they could eat. They gave up. Accordingly, after performing his family's crude brand of tashlich, Max sat at the kitchen table to enjoy a hearty breakfast of biscuits and sausage gravy. Usually, after breakfast and before school, Max helped Daddy in the notion shop below their apartment, dusting shelves with a sawed-off broomstick topped with a crown of chicken feathers, just as Ruby helped her daddy in the fields, digging furrows, sowing seeds, and pulling weeds. Saturdays, while Daddy felt the need to do business himself, he let the boy off the rein for the Sabbath. Ruby's people were Seventh-day Adventists, but as there was no church of that denomination closer than 50 miles away, she had the day free too. Sabbaths were their best time together all week, filled with long, lovely hours of play and dreamy conversation while lying flat on their backs in the sun. Saturday passed, the two had discussed a matter of extreme importance. It was no secret to them that white and black children could enjoy intimacy only until a certain age, the age when they should know better. Once they knew better, the friendship was over. Max and Ruby sensed that time approached, and it frightened them. They loved each other. If they were separated, there would be no replacement friends. Each was a unique article within their milieu. As his classmates never tired of reminding him, Max was the singular Jew boy in his school and town, and Ruby was extraordinarily tall for her age, towering over her contemporaries, boys and girls alike. Her mother told her she'd inherited the grand stature of her Maasai forebears, which meant little to Ruby Alfreda. "Maasai Shamai," she'd say, waving an arm dismissively in imitation of Max's grandfather, whom she knew some. If anything, she resented those tribal ancestors who'd given her a trait she did not want, one that distinguished her to the point of social exclusion and stinging cruelties from other children, both black and white. The affection between Max and Ruby was proof positive that difference can be as bonding as similarity. Max belonged to a family that, while not wealthy, enjoyed financial security. Sassaport's Fabrics, Fancy Goods, and Notions was the sole retail merchant in a town frustrated by the inconvenience of mail-order goods, half of which arrived late, damaged, or otherwise not as expected. Husbands looking for a piece of luxury to gift their hard-working wives could leave Sassaport's with a yard of velvet, another of lace, a cut-glass vial of scent, or even a snow globe featuring President Teddy Roosevelt on a reared-up horse. Their wives could purchase anything from silk-lined dancing shoes that their eldest daughter might attract a beau of quality at a family wedding, to vibrantly painted chamber pots acquired to discourage their husbands from pissing out the bedroom window. Children came to the store for the selection of penny candy displayed in a tower of mason jars in the front window, next to the beard pomades and bouquets of dyed feathers meant to be pinned to a lady's hat. Max may have been the solitary Jew boy in town, and thus the subject of rude inquiry about his family's supposed hoard of gold coins or the horns hidden by the hair of his head, but access to penny candy gave him a grudging cachet even among the bullies who pestered him. Ruby was the fourth and middle child of a sharecropper. From the tenderest age, she suffered far more hours of hard labor a day than schooling, but as she was black, no one beyond her family much cared. Nonetheless, unlike her brothers and sisters, she could read and write. Max taught her how under the stately weeping willows of Yellow Jacket Creek. For her part, Ruby taught Max what her mother taught her about wild vegetation, edible and non, medicinal and poisonous, along with what omens were signified by the west wind, speckled fish, and the habits of hawks. It was a fair exchange. Both children were exceedingly smart. While they knew their days as companions were numbered, what bothered them, what perturbed them utterly, was not knowing on what day that end might occur. Ruby's brother Joshua told her it happened suddenly. One day you had a white friend, and the next you did not. It was a grave, inescapable matter. Sometimes, Joshua swore, whole families moved in the night to achieve the goal. Ruby wasn't sure she believed that, but knew she and Max had to find out when they'd be torn asunder before it was too late. If they had time to prepare, they could design a network of secret places to rendezvous, or maybe run away. "I've got it," Ruby said suddenly that fair Saturday in September while they lay together on the grass watching the hooks of their fishing lines bob in the creek's currents. "We can go up to Mahaley's house and ask her. She'll know." Mahaley Lancaster, the oracle of Heard County, Georgia. A woman who could find a lost wallet or identify a future husband using common playing cards in the ashes of her fireplace. Her reputation was widespread. Her predictions were remarkably reliable. People were known to travel from Alabama and Florida for her services. How she did what she did was anybody's guess. She claimed she was born with a call, which the world of the faithful believed a clear sign of the Lord's favor, one that bore the gift of prophecy. No one knew anyone alive who could corroborate the claim, so maybe it was true, maybe not. The very mention of Mahaley's name sent shivers down Max's spine. He heard his grandmother's voice admonish him the only time he ever dared mention the seer at home. "Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," Bubby said, shaking a long bony finger and looking very much a witch herself. The boy was impressed. He knew many people who were afraid of Mahaley and stayed that way until they'd a need of her services, but Bubby was the first person he ever knew of liked to kill her. Bubby knew the seer from her schoolmarm days, when Mahaley was young and before she lost her left eye. Her friend Sadie's child was in her classroom. Back then, she wasn't so bad. She didn't tell fortunes for money yet, but she dressed like something between a whore and a rough rider, all the while thumping a Bible every Sunday over to the Lebanon Baptist Church. Impossibly tall like Ruby, she was gaunt to boot, with the long cheeks of a horse. Her face was plain as a pancake. On church days, she wore rouge in reds and purples, as if her unremarkable features were worthy of ornamentation. In the younger days, she was judged peculiar, maybe, but not outright crazy. Bubby opined it was the loss of her eye due to a fateful fall with a flinty rock in hand that tipped her into lunacy. For all that, she was shrewd. It was rumored she was quietly buying up vast acres of farmland with her sorcery money, and studying the practice of law as well. She lived in a ramshackle wood and tar paper cabin miles out of town and also smelled bad. Ruby Alfreda Johnson discounted all that. In convincing Max to approach the witch, she emphasized the accuracy of Mahaley's predictions. She could tell you more than where that lost earring was or who you would marry. She could tell you when you would die. That astonished him. "All for a dollar and a dime," Ruby said, getting to her feet and brushing off her skirt. "A dollar for her and a dime for her dogs. You bring the dollar next week, and I'll bring the 10 cent. Max's eyes bugged. He scrambled up and faced her square. "A dollar? Me?" he said. "Where am I going to get a dollar?" Ruby looked at him as she would an idiot child. "Same place I'm getting my dime, from wherever your mama hides her hard money. Don't tell me you don't know where that is." The boy felt a rush of anticipation and anxiety both. It was as if a trail of fire ants had crawled up his leg and bit him, only nothing hurt. "I don't know if I can do that, Ruby." She punched him, but not hard, in the tricep. "Course you can." Her certainty irritated him. "But why do you only have to get a dime and me a whole damn dollar?" She gave him the idiot child look again, raised her palms to heaven, then rolled her eyes. "You think there's a whole damn dollar anywhere in my mama's possession?" He reddened, feeling guilty for having pointed out the great gulf between her station in life and his. To his credit, he never saw them as opposing ends of the same pole. He just saw them as friends. Best friends. For whom, he quietly realized, he would beg, borrow, or steal. "All right, then," he said. He pursed his lips and breathed in deeply. His chest filled with quiet determination. "I'll do it." She threw an arm around his shoulder and, being the taller, lay her head on top of his. "It'll justify the whoopin', Max, I promise." He trusted her. He figured Mahaley Lancaster would indeed be worth whatever punishment his father summoned, although he never hit him, so it wouldn't be the whoopin' Ruby risked. That morning he lollygagged at table, pushing his gravy-soaked biscuit around the plate with a fork. As soon as she'd fed her boy, it was Mama's habit to bring breakfast downstairs to Daddy and his grandparents, who both worked the shop's floor. Max waited while she noisily descended the back steps to Daddy's storeroom with a coffee pot and plate of sweet rolls in hand. He waited until he heard the storeroom door open and shut, then scurried over to the pantry. Standing on a chair, he reached up to the third shelf behind the back row of spice bottles, for a medium-sized tobacco box made of tin. He lifted it out. It had an airtight seal. It was hard to open. But he pulled and got the job done. Inside was a heap of glittering silver coins, all jumbled up. There were so many, Max decided no one would notice any were missing unless they sat down to count them. He grabbed 2 quarters and a half dollar and stuffed them swiftly into his trouser pocket. He had trouble getting the top back on the box tightly. The front edge kept popping open. He pushed the box against the wall and pounded it with his fist to get the lid shut tight, cursing when he realized he dented the thing at one of the corners. It was a tiny dent, yet there it was. He called out to heaven, "Don't let Mama find it." The trudge, trudge, trudge of her footsteps ascending the stairs came to him. There was nothing else to do but put the box and chair back in place and rush to his seat at the table, where he resumed poking around an empty plate. His face went dark as he worked to still his breath. Mama appeared. She halted mid-stride on the way to her sewing pile to place a hand on his brow. You feel cool, but you're looking flushed and you're sweating, too. I'm not entirely sure you should be going out to play around with that ruby today. Max gave her his most irresistible good boy look, wide of eye, pleading a brow. Oh, Mama, please? Please, mayn't I go? I'm feeling fine, I swear. She relented. Once out of the house, Max ran as fast as his short, plump legs could carry him to a prearranged spot past the edge of town. He felt the coins through the rough cotton of his pants. They burned. He pushed down his guilt and ignored it. Mama might not even notice they were gone for a month. Plenty of time to worry. The road was a thoroughfare of dirt and overgrown weeds tamped down by the steady hooves of horses and mules. It led more or less directly to Mahaley's house. At the place where a peddler had piled up a heap of stones to point the way in and out of town, he turned into a field of wildflowers and ran until he achieved the stand of willows at Yellow Jacket Creek. Though the wildflowers reached almost to his neck, Ruby stood near waist-high in them. She held a hand up to her brow. Her head moved right to left, left to right, searching for him. His heart leapt. He raised an arm above his head. "Here I am!" he shouted, waving madly. Ruby hopped up and down. They reached each other and stood hugging and laughing. Max's guilt resolved itself. Their adventure had begun. Adventure was the trademark of their friendship. They'd met at a critical moment for each in the aftermath of danger. One morning, Ruby was pursued by a gang of insecure, jealous boys who wanted to cut her down to size. A girl child their age had no business being bigger than them. Their leader, a stocky, pig-faced boy, waved a pocket knife above his head. About the same time, Max was chased by a band of shiftless young Methodists who threatened to tie him down and re-circumcise him. Although both children escaped mutilation by being fleet of foot and knowing where to hide, afterward their lives felt worthless. It was not the first time they'd been bullied, and it would not be the last. In their eyes, the future looked like an endless cycle of loneliness and flight. By afternoon, each was chin-deep in grief and headed for a crumbled deer blind near the creek, a secret refuge they thought no one else knew. They entered from opposite directions, each intending to sit there for as long as it took to come to peace. On entering, they near collided. Stunned, they stood stock still and stared at each other. Max saw the sadness in Ruby's eyes. She saw the same in his. The tall black girl and short white boy understood each other immediately. Without speaking, they went deep inside the deer blind's wreckage together. They sat on a fallen board side by side, moon-faced, calming their breath. When the latter was achieved, they introduced themselves. You that boy Max by the candy shop, ain't you? Ruby said. He appreciated that she didn't say Jew boy, just boy. He nodded. And you're Ruby. I heard of you, he said. Kids say a giant came down from the sky on a beanstalk and fooled with your mama, and that's why there's so much of you. I always thought that particularly stupid. She appreciated his assessment. So what you doing settin' in here, Max? She asked. Same as you, I expect. Hiding from a cruel world. She broke into a smile then, a big one. He wasn't sure what was funny, but he found her beautiful. It's hard being the onliest one, ain't it? She said softly. He agreed. They talked for hours then, finding much in common. By the time they brushed themselves off and left for home, they'd vowed friendship everlasting. 2 years later, nothing had changed. They kept constant company. They supported and protected each other. The idea that anyone had the power to separate them was a nightmare to them, a tragedy. It's gonna be a trial of a walk to the Oracle's house, Ruby said. She wore a muslin shirt stitched by her mother, a long flower sack skirt, and tattered high-buttoned shoes, the best she had for long-distance walking. Around her waist, she tied a piece of rope from which dangled a drawstring burlap bag and a small jug sealed with a cork. She patted them. I figured we'd need water and summat to eat. Max appreciated the way Ruby always thought ahead. He counted on her to prepare for every eventuality. He thought of himself as more the battering ram type, a boy who shouldered his way forward without a plan, playing it by instinct no matter what the obstacles. It was a fantasy and he knew it. His shoulders could barely knock aside the thicket of wildflowers around them, but he had ambitions. He grinned. That's absolutely right. Thank you for thinking on it. Ruby grinned back. His praise always warmed her. They set out. They walked the morning away. At first they chatted and joked around, but after a while grew thoughtful and taciturn. The landscape encouraged quietude. No wagons or riders passed them on the road. The air was dead, still, hot. Thick stands of trees by the side of the road offered no breeze to cool them. Oak and pine stood silent, motionless, cast in shadow, bearing grave witness to Max and Ruby's larceny, their eager pursuit of sinful acts. As the noon approached, Max stopped, sat in the road, and voiced his opinion that maybe, just maybe, Ruby didn't know where she was going. Ruby stuck her chin loftily in the air. She reached into her deep skirt pocket and withdrew a hand-drawn map on a scrap of cardboard. My brother Franklin made us a map, she said. I'm fair curious how he came by the route. He wouldn't tell me, but he swears this is it. Max took the map. Nothing was labeled, as Franklin didn't know his letters, but the boy recognized his pictographs, both the major twists of the road, the hills, and the place where river and creek met. Where are we now? He asked. Ruby pointed to a spot dotted with Franklin's symbol for pine trees. They looked relatively close to a big X. Presumably Mahaley's house. Right to there. Less than an hour to the place where we turn in. Max was satisfied. He apologized for doubting her. He got to his feet. They continued. By the time Mahaley's house rose in the distance, their water was gone. Ruby's hardtack and boiled egg were gone, too. The dust of the road mingled with their sweat to make dark, dirty trails from their hairlines to their chins. Too bad we can't wash up, Max said. I doubt Miss Mahaley minds. Ruby took his hand. They squeezed their palms together for courage and walked on down the semi-cleared path that led from the road to their destination. When they were a few yards from the front door, they halted next to a brick well, their eyes large as saucers as they took in what was before them. The cabin was made up of more kinds of wood than either of them knew, scraps of tin, a newspaper balled up tight as a stone. It had a long stick-and-mud chimney from which smoke spewed despite the warmth of the day. By the front porch, a possum and two squirrels dangled dead, hung by their tails from ropes nailed into the ceiling. An outhouse stood close by. Next to the cinder-block stairs leading up to the front door, a small square herb and vegetable garden was encased in a wire mesh against those who would prey upon it. Chickens pecked the dirt outside the wire. Mahaley's mule and a pack of rangy dogs lounged behind a wood fence that reached from the front all the way around the back. On seeing them, the latter bounded up as close as they could get, barking. The children leaned into each other. Ruby pointed out in as brave a voice as she could summon that the dogs did not growl. At least there was that. Max heard her and felt a little calmer, but on the whole, he was close to terrified. The door creaked open. Miss Mahaley Lancaster emerged from the shadows to stand at the top of the stairs, wiping her long white hands on an apron. She wore several skirts of different patterns and lengths, a yellow gentleman's shirt, which was likely white when it was new, and surprisingly, the very latest hat, a gray felt cloche to which she attached the dried coxcomb of a rooster. Around her waist was the same rope Ruby tied around hers. Mahaley's had burlap sacks and vessels hanging from her rope as well, but larger ones, and there were more of them. The sun faced her. She wore a glass marble in her empty eye socket. The blue pupil and network of veins she'd painted over it did not obscure the light that bounced off that strange, immobile eye, light that came at the children in piercing rays. It near blinded them. They squinted and held up their hands against it. "She's like the burning bush," thought Max. "Like the Holy Spirit," thought Ruby. "What you two ragamuffins looking for round here?" the seer said. Her voice was surprising. It had a soft tone and round notes. It was younger than expected, but maybe Mahaley was too. Legends, myths, and seers live old in the mind of their observers. The children thought her voice was part of her sorcery, that she altered it to seduce them like the Hansel and Gretel witch Uncle Washington told them about. But it was quite natural. Ruby was 6 months older than Max. She was already 10. As oldest, she took it upon herself to speak. "We are here to have our fortune told," she said. "We have the dollar and the dime." She pulled out pennies from her shirt and nudged Max with an elbow. He produced his 2 quarters and 50-cent piece. Mahaley regarded the money, stood aside her door, and gestured. "Come on in, then." The children ascended the cement block stairs, not hesitantly exactly, but slowly. Each handed over payment on entering the cabin. The first thing Max noticed as he passed the witch and dropped his coins into her palm was that she didn't smell bad. She smelled like everybody else. The interior of Mahaley's house brushed all other thoughts aside. It felt small, cramped. There was a fireplace with a cauldron on a spit. Flames licked the pot's bottom. Whatever brewed within it smelled spicy and sweet and earthy, too. A narrow mattress framed by pieces of ironwork lashed together lay close by, parallel to the fire. Stacks of books leaned against it. Playing cards were spread over a homemade bed quilt in groups of 3 and 5. Against the far wall was a table, 2 chairs, and a sink on a stand with a mounted butcher's board beside it. There were more oil lamps than Max had ever seen in one room, though none were lit. On the walls were pinned whole pages of newspapers and magazines, mixing up portraits of ladies' garments and hairstyles with politicians and statewide news. The children settled into the 2 chairs. Mahaley put their coins in a blue jar on the mantel and stood before them, hands on hips.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?